Welcome back, everyone. This is Ryan Selkis. You're listening to another episode of Messari's Unqualified Opinions, where each week I discuss key industry trends with crypto's top investors, builders, and thinkers. Just a reminder, Messari is much more than a podcast company. So if you're an industry professional or crypto investor, head over to Messari.io and check out Messari Pro, our crypto toolkit that offers best-in-class research, advanced screening, and charting tools to keep you ahead of the investing curve, plus a new enterprise alerts tool. We're also hosting the industry's largest virtual event, the Mainnet, this June 1st through 3rd, with over 50 hours of programming, 100 confirmed speakers, and virtual networking that's so seamless, you'll feel like you're actually there. 50% of the profits are heading to COVID relief, so go reserve your spot today at mainnet.events. That's Messari.io for pro research and tools, and mainnet.events for the best virtual event you'll attend this year. With that, strap in for another episode. Going to be a good one. This episode of the podcast brought to you by Luca. Save money this tax season with Luca Tax, the only time-tested crypto tax software. Luca has listened to your feedback and now lets you calculate capital gains and losses, seeing the results using three different accounting methods side by side, all for free. You only pay if you want to see their detailed tax reports and submit your forms using their software. Luca supports unlimited transaction downloads from all major exchanges and wallets and helps you optimize your tax reporting so you can max out this year's refunds or minimize how much you have to pay. Luca wants to help Messari's Unqualified Opinions listeners save even more this year. So use promo code MESSARITAX and you'll get a discount. Much more importantly, you'll do your taxes correctly and stay out of jail. Download Luca Tax at Luca with two Ks, tax.com, and save money this tax season. This episode is brought to you by Bitstamp, the original crypto exchange. 2011 is a long time. This is their third Bitcoin halving, and Bitstamp has been the preferred exchange for serious traders and investors all along the way. 4 million customers, including top financial institutions worldwide, use Bitstamp. Check them out because they've got some serious professional-grade trading technology, including a matching engine from NASDAQ, some of the best APIs in the industry, and TradeView, their advanced trading interface, includes live charting and deep analytical tools that are available on web and mobile. Bitstamp also delivers unmatched customer service, no robots, real live people around the clock via phone, email, and social media if you have issues, but you won't. Join over 4 million traders, download the Bitstamp app from the App Store and Google Play, or visit bitstamp.net/pro to get started. That's bitstamp.net/pro, and they're hooking you up with a discount for Messari Pro as well using promo code Bitstamp. This episode of the podcast brought to you by Crypto.com. We know times are tough. That's why Crypto.com is introducing three different measures to help its community with their new Crypto.com app and credit card. First, they're waiving 3.5% credit card fee on all crypto purchases in the next 3 months. They're also offering 10% back when you use the MCO Visa card on food and grocery shopping. And as always, you can buy gift cards on the Crypto.com app for merchants like Whole Foods, Safeway, Burger King, and more, with 20% back on food and an additional 10% back on groceries. So download the Crypto.com app today.
This podcast is presented by Blockworks Group, one of the top blockchain events and media production companies I've worked with. For exclusive content and events that could help you with insight into the crypto and blockchain space, check them out at blockworksgroup.io and you will not be disappointed.
All right, everyone. Welcome back to Messari's Unqualified Opinions. I'm Ryan Selkis at 2-Bit Idiots. Some of you have seen me on the live stream, but for those that haven't, got a little bit of change up top going on. Same show though, same high quality guests, same good conversations. And today is no different. I'm excited to have a conversation with one of the hottest infrastructure companies in crypto and founder Michael Schall of Fireblocks, founder and CEO of Fireblocks. We're going to talk all about institutional grade infrastructure for conducting trading and greasing the wheels for institutional adoption of crypto. Michael, hot off the press right before we signed online here just this morning. Today is April 30th. We're recording this, is probably getting produced and published in early May. But it was announced that you've now facilitated $30 billion in digital asset transfers plus an Asian expansion. So obviously a ton going on in a short amount of time. The company is fairly young, has an impressive group of backers and customers, though. Why don't we start by just giving people some context in terms of your background and history and how you ultimately got full-time into the crypto market and you know, came to build Fireblocks, which, you know, we now know is powering a number of the top trading desks and other institutional buyers.
Yeah, sounds good. So first of all, Ryan, thanks for having me on the show, and really appreciate it. I'll give a bit about a background about myself. I spent the last two decades in the cybersecurity space. Back in the days, I actually started in the Israeli Cyber Command, as you can hear from my accent. Was basically serving over there for 4 years. And around 2011, I started my previous startup, which was doing cybersecurity for smartphones for enterprise customers. It was basically a solution to help cybersecurity organizations in all the big banks, all the big technology companies to navigate the adoption of smartphones and to protect the employees of those companies from cyber attacks, like what happened to Jeff Bezos recently. I think that was all over the news. And in 2015, we got acquired by Checkpoint, which is the biggest cybersecurity vendor. They invented the firewall in the beginning of the 90s. And I was running their mobile and cloud security business, so essentially their transformational division. And in 2017, something quite interesting happened. It's unfortunate, but for me at least was sort of what brought me to crypto. There were four exchanges in South Korea that got hacked by what later was discovered as the North Korean basically a group of hackers that are backed by the North Korean government, and they were able to steal $200 million worth of crypto basically overnight from those four exchanges. And we found ourselves, because of our expertise in mobile investigation and stuff like that, we find ourselves part of the investigation team that was looking into that hack. And that was actually the first time that I got involved and understood that there is a fairly active institutional market around crypto. So still while working at Checkpoint, I started to have those conversations with a lot of the exchanges and brokers and hedge funds and institutional asset managers in the cryptocurrency space. Mm-hmm. They were quite open with us, explaining how they operate, what are the problems they have, what are the deficiencies, and what are the issues that they are facing. And essentially, on the back of it, we were able to, what we believe seems to be everybody else believe the same. We were able to find and build a very good solution to essentially serve that tier of the market.
Mm-hmm. And so, talk a little bit about some of the kind of incremental value add that you're bringing to the table, because the institutional market in particular is always at the bleeding edge. You need better, faster, cheaper kind of every step along the way. And as there's been more liquidity, as there's been more global exchanges that have popped up, as the integrations that are required to actually move money efficiently across the globe get more complex and really ever changing. There's about a million different decisions that these investors need to make when it comes to understanding the regulatory compliance of who they're working with, understanding the security of the systems. What components are you able to abstract away that have been most valuable and reduce the pain points for these customers the most versus what might have been traditionally taken care of in-house by either a compliance team or an internal tech team?
Yeah, so I think just in general, most of our customers, they either transition to us from some kind of an internal build or internal type of system, mm-hmm. or they were using a third-party service providers or custodians that were solving part of the problem, but mm-hmm. and either they were not solving it in a way that was good enough, or they actually were not completing the whole spectrum of things that need to be solved. Mm-hmm. So probably to actually give a better answer, maybe I'll give my personal view on where the market was when we started, where it is now, and what are sort of the missing pieces, right? For if you're an institution that whether you're an exchange or you're a hedge fund or you're a prop trading desk or payment provider, I think eventually what you realize is that all those guys have a pretty common set of problems. And the first problem that you have is, how do I basically store or custodize the asset, right? And I think this is probably like, you know, the most discussed topic in the market, which is like always when you go to people from traditional market, like custody is never an issue. Here, custody is a major issue. And the storage of the private keys and the access to the private keys is something that is quite, is actually like, you know, the break of make, right, for a lot of those firms. Traditionally, like, you know, we had cold storage. I think that, like, you know, cold storage becomes, like, you know, less and less relevant. Again, there are geographies like Japan and Korea that, you know, it's sort of a regulatory necessity. But in Europe and the United States, we see sort of, like, you know, the adoption of, like, you know, more secure solutions that provide you high SLA. And generally speaking, in order to create a very liquid market and a very efficient market, you have to have an online high SLA storage component that allows you all the highest level of cybersecurity to be resilient against external cyber attack and internal cyber attacks, and also internal governance. So that's like component number one. Mm-hmm. Component number two, which is actually the piece that we are solving and no one else is solving, is actually how do you transfer your liquidity across the ecosystem, right? Because the market has transformed from basically like the VC type of hedge funds that were buying tokens or investing only long in Bitcoin to folks that are basically like, you know, coming from Goldman Sachs and like, you know, from Took Sigma and opening their own hedge funds. And like, you know, even the retail guys are continuously trading and liquidity has to move, right? Basically, the assets need to move from one venue to another venue to third wallet. And we have a lot of blockchains. We have a lot of different protocols. We have a lot of different liquidity venues out there in the market. And that creates a huge complexity for people to basically transfer the assets, right? So to do it securely, it's actually, you almost need like a PhD degree, right? In computer science, because you need to go, you need to copy paste the deposit address from your account on Coinbase. You need to understand it's actually your Bitcoin and not Bitcoin Cash account. You need to basically pass it into your wallet. You need to understand that no one is man in the middling you. You're not being spoofed. You didn't accidentally took an address of one counterparty and send it to the different counterparty because you looked at an Excel spreadsheet. And you know, the space is just full of, you know, of a lot of bad stories of either disaster or near disaster stories of how things went really wrong there. And what we basically are able to solve is completely abstract that layer, make it as simple and resilient as basically doing a Swift transfer. I mean, there is nothing that can go wrong. It will always arrive to the destination. You don't need to like do test transfers. You don't need to check with your counterparty, etc. And you know that really is sort of just like, you know, to another sentence on this. That really not only provided a much higher degree of security. What actually it does, it basically reduced the operational cost to operate the business because you need to have like way less people, and actually also increases the top line. Because now you can utilize either your capital much faster or you stack less on credit lines with your counterparties in terms of settlements. And there are a lot of different benefits that actually our customers are reaping through this sort of chain of operations and liquidity.
Mm-hmm. I think the big innovation here is for OTC desks and lenders, it seems, primarily today. Do you find yourselves in competition with like prime brokers that are facilitating best execution, or is this more underpinning that could interface with a, you know, prime broker solution like Fidelity's offering or Tagomi or the others just as easily as your existing OTC base?
Yeah, so it's actually the infrastructure basically allows you, if you are a hedge fund, the infrastructure allows you either to self-prime yourself or for prime brokers, basically it's an infrastructure for them to operate. So we don't deal with, we don't trade, we don't do best execution. That's not our bread and butter. That's not our skill set. But all the underlying infrastructure of let's call it a post-trade settlement, or it's actually like, you know, trade settlement, because with blockchain you're actually able to get it to, not to post-trade, but actually to the trade itself. That's what we provide. And we have prime brokers, like, for example, a newcomer to the family or to the ecosystem is Kvaria, which is a prime broker based out of the UK and Switzerland that is using us as an infrastructure. Also, like, you know, all the names that you drop, like, you know, are in different phases of working with us. And and it's really sort of an infrastructure that allows either prime brokers to operate very efficiently and securely, or if you don't want to use a prime broker because you're able to do everything yourself, you can actually take our infrastructure. We have all the big lending providers already on our platform. You can borrow from them, get leverage, deploy it on 20 exchanges, trade, rebalance, return the loan.
Have you seen some of your customers keep less money on exchanges after using Fireblocks, or is this more about peace of mind as funds are flowing and making sure that there are no man-in-the-middle attacks or botched handoffs between the different components of the pipeline? Because it seems to me that with the system that's been designed, one of the primary benefits and one of the primary value adds would just be improving the ROI on your invested capital or reducing your working capital commitments to all these different venues. Have you been able to kind of measure any material change before and after? Because I'm curious, you know, what the delta has been for, you know, teams that A, have done this internally, or B, just used other tools that weren't as feature complete. And obviously this is important as you think about the centralization risks that some of the major exchanges pose, not just for Bitcoin, but for other assets kind of further down the line.
Yeah. So I think it's hard for me to answer exactly that question in terms of, is there a difference between how much they keep on exchanges right now compared to how much they kept before, right? Because we don't know how much they kept before. What we can say is definitely that customers that we worked with, they see around 30% improvement on their capital when they are working with our system. Sort of like, you know, that's like a direct improvement, almost like, you know, on their capital in terms of movement. It's all like, mm-hmm. It's all related to the fact that it all starts like, you know, with the security, right? So the fact that we solved, and to be honest, like, you know, I've been in the cybersecurity space for about 20 years. It's actually, like, you know, the first time that I've seen such a direct correlation between security and ROI, or security and money, right? But the fact that you're actually able to solve and abstract all the security protocols, to simplify them and to move it from an hour or 15 minutes to basically a second, right? That creates a lot of efficiency around how liquidity is being transferred. So, and there are also, like, you know, some incremental improvements over there. So, for example, we announced a week ago, our new initiatives with Bitstamp that mm-hmm. basically, because of the specific mechanisms that we have around storage, which is related more to the multi-party computation, they are now crediting our customers with one confirmation. After one confirmation instead of, like, you know, three confirmations. So basically it reduced their time to credit from 45 minutes on Bitcoin to 15 minutes on Bitcoin. And we are now actually going into initiative with multiple exchanges where it's actually going to be zero confirmation, right? So you can actually get, like, credit immediately, right, for the deployment. Now, I don't think, I mean, if I had to guess, I'm not sure that, like, you know, people are keeping more assets off exchanges. Maybe, like, you know, they keep assets off exchanges during the times that they don't trade, for example, like, you know, overnight or something like that. But what it does allow them is to sort of seize opportunities much faster when they see arbitrage opportunities or when they basically need to execute trades from a customer to an exchange with our technology.
Mm-hmm. And on the, you know, I think that's part of a larger trend with flash loans and lending in general, with basically being able to allow for credits even before they've been confirmed, depending on the credit worthiness. So this is kind of in part a security notch in your belts, and you know, kind of indication from some of the leading exchanges that yes, the pipes work and it's secure transfer and it's reliable, and they know that there's, you know, very little risk of allowing zero confirmation transactions with Fireblocks customers. But at the same time, I think it's part of a larger trend in the lending ecosystem to extend credit and not just in terms of interest rates, but in terms of features like faster access to liquidity or things you'd expect in a legacy financial system, but that technically have been challenging to do historically within crypto. Have you extended some of those discussions to the exchanges themselves? Because, you know, we just saw a high profile outage yesterday at Coinbase. I know it's not exactly the same, but every couple of months, you know, one of the major exchanges has some type of issue. Rarely it's a theft or a hack. Not too rarely. Obviously it's been, you know, a persistent issue long-term for crypto. But there's regular performance issues that almost always stem from how the money gets moved around, and it seems like on the one hand, this is proprietary technology that really should be built in-house at the exchange level, but there are a number that might benefit from it when they're thinking about connecting their own internal architecture to external flows. I'm not sure if that's a target for you at all. Or if that's just a much longer cycle, given the amount of money that they're actually, you know, facilitating.
So the reality is that, like, we actually have a good penetration into the exchange space. We have a couple of exchanges that are actually using us as their infrastructure, and we having, and I think there are basically, like, you know, three or four now that are going to onboard with us in the next 60 days or so. And we are seeing, I think, like, you know, what we are seeing is two things, right? Like, how clearly, like, you know, the big exchanges, as mentioned, like Coinbase and Binance and some of those, they have huge, I mean, they're technology companies, right? More than anything else. And they have their own custody solutions. They have their own appetite in terms of how they want security to be done. And it's really sort of, like, you know, a question for us, like, or basically, like, you know, we actually put, like, fairly interesting models in place in terms of how we can work with them. But in the end of the day, they do view that they need to be in a certain possession of the asset when they extending credit to you. And it's true that, like, you know, as you mentioned about Coinbase, and I think, like, you know, the worst that we've seen was on March 12 and 13, right? When basically during that 48-hour period, almost all the major exchanges experienced some kind of downtime, right? Like, you know, the most famous was basically, like, you know, BitMEX, right? But, like, we've seen Hobby, Coinbase, all those guys were down. And clearly it affects us. It affects, like, you know, our customers. It can affect them, like, you know, on the movement of the money. It can affect them on the trading, because usually, for example, BitMEX, they were completely DDoSed in terms of their functionality. So you couldn't almost, like, you know, trade there. But the reality is that, like, you know, those guys need to, I mean, I think those guys are doing a good job, and, like, you know, they're investing in sort of maturing their tech stack. At the end of the day, I think at some point the regulators will basically force them to be up to the standard of NASDAQ, or, you know, something which is, like, really institutional grade that can withstand the load that happens during those days.
Mm-hmm. Are there exchanges you won't work with because of compatibility issues or other partners, or are all of these solvable problems from your perspective?
So we currently integrated with almost 30 exchanges, right? Mm-hmm. We have all the top tier and we have all the top tier exchanges, all the mid exchanges, and some of the small exchanges. 30 is already, like, a very vast list. Generally speaking, for our basic integration, we have two modes. Either we integrate with their APIs that they have for treasury management, if they have those APIs, or if they don't have APIs, we have another mode in which we basically extend our wallet wallet technology to them, and then they can essentially standardize on our wallet. And a lot of them actually decide to basically move their infrastructure to our wallet. So all the problems, whatever they are either fully solvable on our end, or if needed, like, you know, we can solve it in some form of partnership.
This episode of the podcast is brought to you by Luca. Save money this tax season with Luca Tax, the only time-tested crypto tax software. Luca has listened to your feedback and now lets you calculate capital gains and losses, seeing the results using three different accounting methods side by side, all for free. You only pay if you want to see their detailed tax reports and submit your forms using their software. Luca supports unlimited transaction downloads from all major exchanges and wallets, and helps you optimize your tax reporting so you can max out this year's refund or minimize how much you have to pay. Luca wants to help Messari's Unqualified Opinions listeners save even more this year. So use promo code MessariTax and you'll get a discount. Much more importantly, you'll do your taxes correctly and stay out of jail. Download Luca Tax at Luca with two Ks, tax.com, and save money this tax season. Thanks to our sponsor, Bitstamp, for making this special halving series possible. Bitstamp's the original global crypto exchange. We're proud to be celebrating their third Bitcoin halving. Doesn't get much more OG than that. Since 2011, Bitstamp's been the preferred exchange for serious traders and investors worldwide, with over 4 million customers, including top financial institutions. They've got some serious trading tech, matching engine from NASDAQ, the best APIs in the industry, and TradeView, their advanced trading interface with live charting and deep analytical tools that are available on web and mobile. So you can join the 4 million traders on Bitstamp by downloading their app, the App Store or Google Play, or go to bitstamp.net/pro to get started. And a reminder for Bitstamp users, Messari is now offering 25% off of Messari Pro, our professional analytics toolkit with best-in-class research and advanced tools to help identify your next investments using promo code Bitstamp. That's Messari.io, offer code Bitstamp to get ahead of the crypto curve. This episode of the podcast brought to you by Crypto.com. We know times are tough. That's why Crypto.com is introducing three different measures to help its community with their new Crypto.com app and credit card. First, they're waiving the 3.5% credit card fee on all crypto purchases in the next 3 months. They're also offering 10% back when you use the MCO Visa card on food and grocery shopping. And as always, you can buy gift cards on the Crypto.com app for merchants like Whole Foods, Safeway, Burger King, and more, with 20% back on food and an additional 10% back on groceries. So download the Crypto.com app today. And in terms of asset coverage, most institutional interest, most liquidity is in Bitcoin and then Ether, and then it falls off pretty dramatically. How do you support new assets, new kind of underlying blockchains, and how many assets do you currently support or are thinking about adding support for this year?
Yes. So we support the top 10 assets, like in the top 10 blockchains. So Bitcoin, Cash, Litecoin, Ripple. We just announced like support for Stellar. We support Ethereum. We support all the ERC-20s ERC, 1400 as well, as long as they're standard. And usually it takes us 24 hours or so to onboard a new ERC-20, just because we're essentially doing the validation that it's a valid contract. Mm-hmm. In terms of ongoing asset or new blockchain onboarding, we usually onboard a blockchain once a month. We're currently looking on a model of basically working with new blockchain protocols in a way that they can essentially subsidize the integration and create, basically extend the teams that we have in place to support multiple blockchain developments in a given period of time.
Mm-hmm. I think common sense typically prevails when it comes to support, because some things that creep into the top 20 end up falling out of the top 100 rather quickly, because there is this chasm that has to be crossed before any deep-pocketed investors actually take some of these projects seriously.
Yeah. So to be quite transparent, what we were doing to date is that we're actually running surveys with our customers. Every quarter we will run a survey and we'll ask them to rate the next three protocols that we need to support. And the last survey that we ran this quarter, again, it has to do with the fact that we already have sort of like, you know, over almost close to 50 customers, but also because we already like, you know, completed the top 10, the survey was very, very, very fragmented. So you already see that after the top 10, sort of like, you know, the interest in new protocols is very pocketed, right? It's very fragmented between regions, different types of business and so on. So we are now basically sort of changing our strategy a little bit in terms of making sure that we are our development and our efforts are best aligned with how we can serve our customers.
And part of that, I have to imagine, is how do you prepare for new blockchain launches, basically being ready right out of the gates? And we've got some high profile ones coming out soon. We've got, Filecoin Libra and Polkadot, being the big three, I think, that are trying to get out the gates this year. Maybe Libra takes a little bit longer. It's also a permission system, so maybe you're thinking about it a little bit differently. What is your kind of roadmap to supporting new blockchains that might come out right out of the gates in the top 10, top 20 in terms of interest and, you know, have significant liquidity from day one because people are looking to make kind of the initial markets?
Yeah, so as you said, because of our dominant position specifically in the market making and OTC category, we became a fairly important infrastructure for those blockchains when they come to the market. So specifically, like, you know, with the names that you've mentioned, we are currently in a very close conversations in terms of making sure how we'll be able to support them. I don't know if, like, you know, straight out of the gate, but, like, you know, almost immediately as they launch. And there is again, Libra is a bit, you know, down the road, I think, in terms of when they're going to be launched. But I think I'm long, like, you know, on we're still, like, you know, very long on that project. And I think that when it will come out, it will have a long and lasting impact on the space. You know, clearly, like, folks like Polkadot, we're really looking into how we can build a model that we will be able to support them as they're coming out. There is a really strong interest to work with them from our community.
I think most people are cautiously optimistic about Libra, at least on the kind of financial side, and obviously they just have a wealth of developers and top talent that's been working on this. Maybe even, you know, more technical talent than are working on most other protocols combined, which is just mind blowing to think about, just given Facebook size and the fact that Facebook as a company is multiples the size of the entire, you know, crypto market cap, right? And people, you know, people often lose sight of that. But I want to talk about stablecoins more generally, and what you're seeing in term, or if there are any unique requirements around stablecoin support, given that most exchange listed stablecoins now are pegged to dollars, and yet they're trading across five or six different major assets, being Tether, USDC, Paxos is kind of the primaries, but then, you know, some other up and coming synthetic US dollars like Binance USD and other exchange listed coins are in the same vein. And then they also trade on different blockchains, right? So a lot of the liquidity right now is on Ethereum. That could just as easily, in theory, be ported over to you know, Bitcoin via Liquid or other new up and coming layer one chains. What complexities does that bring in terms of asset transfer when you don't necessarily have the same, you know, tax implications? You don't have the same volatility concerns, but it is the plumbing of the entire system, and you need to be methodical about how the cash treasury is managed, whether you're at the exchange or at your investor customer base. Is it just any other asset, or what have you seen on the stablecoin side of things, given the explosion in the last few months, especially up to $9 billion now?
Yeah. So just to give you some numbers, out of the $7 billion that we're doing, like in the last 30 days, we've done, like, you know, $7 billion in asset transfer. Out of that, 1.8 was stable coins. Okay, so like about like almost 30% was stable coins. USDT is still the king. So at least like in our platform, right? So I don't know, like, I mean, clearly there is some potential bias into our set of users, but USDT is still like 70% of the volume. And Tether. And USDC, if I'm not mistaken, is the second one with 20%. And then, you know, the others basically, all those other coins, they represent basically 10%. Of our flow. Again, might be like, you know, different across geographies, but that's what we're seeing at least. Stablecoins are extremely important for us because this is where we see the plumbing and the ecosystem really matures. So we talked a bit about Libra, but clearly, like, you know, this is the intersection where it's going to actually disrupt commerce, right? E-commerce and merchant services. And we do know that credit card providers are actively involved in looking into this space. And basically, because once Libra or any one of those stablecoins picks up, right, then it essentially, like, you know, takes, I mean, again, it's a bombastic statement. But in the long run, it basically takes out all the business model of the credit card providers and the payment providers, right? Just to give an example, our smaller customers, they can pay us with credit card, and we use Stripe for that. And Stripe takes 3% on the transaction. But we do incentivize most of our customers to actually pay in stable coins, so USDC or PAX. And at some point, we had a customer that wanted to, I don't know why, but they wanted to pay us in the credit card $30,000. And I don't know, we're not going to pay $1,000 to Stripe and Visa to process a payment, pay us in PAX. So they pay us in PAX. So instead of, like, you know, paying $1,000 and waiting 72 hours for that to arrive in our bank account, we have our own workspace, which is basically our own instance of Fireblocks. We just connected to them over the Fireblocks network. They send us the $30,000. Immediately we have a connection to Paxos, move it to Paxos, liquidate it back into our signature account. All that process took us, I want to say 30 seconds, something like that, right? Basically, like, you know, two Ethereum transactions, and then, like, you know, Paxos, you basically, like, click a button and it goes to your bank account, and it cost us 7 cents, right? So, like, it's like unbelievable reduction, right? Like, you know, when people say that something is going, like, a technology is going to disrupt a different technology, they say, oh, so, like, if it's disrupting, like, you know, by 10%, or sorry, by like 50%, it's not disruption. This is like, you know, a 1,000% or, like, you know, 10,000% disruption in terms of how payments are working today. So I think that, like, you know, stablecoins is going to be, in the next couple of years, probably, like, you know, one of the biggest innovations out there. We are actively involved in that space. We actually have, I didn't touch on it, but we also have an offering which we call tokenization platform, which allows stablecoin issuers to mint and burn tokens. It's actually tightly there is an API you integrate into a bank. So when the dollars arrive, it automatically mints. It has controls to basically break the circuit if there is something which is like some kind of an overflow. So essentially, if for whatever reason the system thinks that you need to mint $1 billion worth of stable coins, right? Like what happened to USDT a year ago or something like that. There's sort of like an automated circuit break that basically moves it to a manual approval. So it's really like, I cannot like disclose names, but we are the technology behind one of the providers that are some of the more interesting providers in one of the FX stable coins.
Very, very cool. Yeah, people, I don't think, realize that there is no reason for businesses with cash on their balance sheet to have credit cards in many cases, right? Especially tech and financial companies. Obviously, there are benefits to having lines of credit open, and you're talking about like working capital management, and you know, particularly for you know, goods manufacturers or you know, companies that deal in supply chain and kind of the physical realm. But in the digital realm, there's basically no reason to have a credit card, right? First of all, if you're losing money and you're not backed by venture capital, it's probably dangerous to extend credit to you anyway. So you're talking about a future where the credit card companies seem as if they will probably diverge between the core consumer business and then the corporate business, which I agree, you know, could be mostly disrupted, if not fully disrupted, at least on the initial payment side by stablecoins. And obviously that's the big long game that I think many in the space are playing right now. But you talk about the $1,000 that you saved on that transaction. It's not just that you can save $1,000, but if someone's giving you a hard time, you can split it with them, right? You can say, hey, we're going to give you $500 as a rebate.
Yeah. Right.
And you're still going to come out way ahead.
Right. Yeah. I mean, look, this is the reason why, first and foremost, right, Visa bought Plaid, right? That's because, I mean, again, different type of technology, but they were significantly making it cheaper to do those reasonably expensive transactions. So I guess the retail is unaware. Most retail users are unaware of, like, you know, the sort of this spread that is being taken on their behalf when they're paying with credit cards. But for the merchants, it's clearly, like, you know, will allow a much more efficient and much cheaper payment method. And so, you know, we're really excited about it. It also has, you know, more advantages. So, for example, we've recently integrated with Compound Finance, which is a decentralized lending and borrowing protocol that we are extremely excited about. So in Compound, you can essentially, with our platform, you can basically deposit into Compound and then you start earning yield on whatever you deposited. And you're earning yield in, like, you know, in ticks of 15 seconds, right? So every block, every Ethereum block, you're basically earning some yield. So you essentially have, like, you know, this ultra dynamic saving account that not necessarily you now to go and lock your funds for like a month or a year with the bank. And if you want to break that, deposit, they take all your yield that you earned by that time. I think that, like, you know, all those elements and all those pieces of the ecosystem, once they stitch together in a way that is seamless for the user, in a way that it's secure for the user, it's sort of mind-blowing what kind of efficiency and what kind of transparency and what kind of reduction even of counterparty risk you can achieve by just utilizing it.
Completely agree. So what are some of the big things on the horizon for Fireblocks the rest of the year? There's a ton of macro tailwinds. Sounds like there's a ton of customer progress. Are there new features or new end markets that you're going to be doubling down on?
Yeah. So as you know, we just announced this morning, we've expanded already. It was like a month and a half ago, we deployed two teams in Asia. So we are expanding our presence in Asia, and, you know, with the COVID-19, probably, like, you know, not in general, like, you know, not the best timing, but we do see just because it's hard to travel over there, but just in general, we see a lot of traction for what we're doing in Asia. I think Asia is particularly a very interesting market because the use cases over there are many cases more advanced. They are much more, from what I'm hearing from people, mainly because of the traditional ecosystem, the traditional financial system is sometimes not as good as in the US or in the Western economies. People sort of, like, you know, leapfrog into crypto and actually, like, you know, more willing to go and do things with crypto, a bit like, you know, there is this always famous analogy to Africa, where in Africa, people never had, like, you know, landline phones, right? They just, like, you know, went from zero to mobile phones and smartphones, right? Like, the landline never happened over there. So it almost feels like, you know, that something similar is happening in Asia. A lot of like, you know, interesting use cases, again, around payments. There are like a lot of the big exchanges that are over there, a lot of trading firms. So we really sort of like, you know, doubling down in that, on that region. You know, in terms of like, you know, functionality, clearly, you know, we have a lot of the lending guys on our platform. We continue to push on more advanced and streamlined integrations with exchanges, which increase like the capital efficiency of our customers and also their security. So we have a lot of things going on in that direction. We also pushed on the innovation around storage. So this announcement is not public yet, but I guess like, you know, by the time that this podcast will be published, it will be out. And anyway, the academic paper was actually published earlier this week. We made an extremely significant breakthrough in MPC technology, multi-party computation technology that powers our wallets. So we just released an academic paper earlier this week, which essentially increases the speed and the performance of MPC by 800%, which is huge compared to like, you know, the current period. So that is itself, and also it allows you to basically do offline signing with MPC. The security proofs over there are more advanced than in any other open MPC protocol. And the most interesting thing about all that compared to potentially like, you know, other people that they have related things that are proprietary, we're actually releasing it to the community. So everybody, all the different providers that are working with MPC or looking to build something by themselves with multi-party computation, they can basically consume this protocol. We're not going to patent it. So, you know, belongs to just in generally speaking, like, you know, we hope that it will improve the security in the ecosystem.
Can you do a quick explain like I'm five on multi-party computation and in particular how that bakes into the product? I know it's probably easier to do on a whiteboard. You have a white wall back there, but not a whiteboard. Maybe your kids draw on it, but yeah. but if you could just work through that and kind of the history of MPC, because there are a few other protocols that have been working on this as well. And I have a feeling, you know, many more people are going to be hearing about this. At least when they're thinking about, you know, security and secure data transfer.
Yeah. So MPC in general, it's a theorem that was in cryptography that exists since the 90s, which basically is quite interesting, sort of a black magic theorem, which basically means that like any calculation that can be done in a centralized location can also be done in a completely distributed way. In a way that, for example, and I think about number, and now we need to essentially multiply those two numbers together and get a result. So we don't need to disclose each other, like, you know, what's the number that we thought about. There can be a protocol between us that somehow, without actually knowing each other's secret, we can actually come to the right result, right? And also guarantee that none of us is actually tricking the other into basically disclosing his secret. So that's sort of like, you know, the general theorem. Probably like, you know, the most famous thing over there is what it's called the millionaire's problem, where you have like five millionaires. They want to calculate their total net worth. None of them want to tell the other guys how much money he exactly have. And still there is sort of a protocol which allows them to calculate what's their total net worth, right? So that's sort of like, you know, the history of MPC. There are like a lot of different applications for it. But generally speaking, like, you know, for many years, it was very computationally intensive. It was the theory exists, the math exists, but to actually compute it was quite complicated and not really practical in terms of like, you know, the time frames that we're looking at. Now, in the last, let's say like, you know, 3-4 years, there were like a series of breakthroughs that in the academic research that essentially took that capability and applied it specifically for signatures around ECDSA and EDDSA, which are the signatures that are most prevalent in all the blockchain protocols. And essentially what they allow to do is something that we call threshold. Threshold is essentially, in a broad sense, it's very similar to multisig. Okay, multisig is also a form of threshold. Basically, we have N parties with secrets, and M out of them, let's say, like, you know, we have six people that they have like a cryptographic secret. Each of those cryptographic secrets are different. And in order to sign a transaction, we need four out of those six to sign, to basically do some kind of protocol between them. And then eventually they can sign a transaction on a public address. They can sign a transaction on a wallet address. And that transaction is basically valid for the blockchain. Okay, that's sort of like threshold signatures. And basically MPC is solving this problem of how do you create a more advanced, a more robust, cheaper multisig. So without, like, you know, getting into the mathematical details over there, because for that, yeah, you really need a whiteboard, and probably, like, you know, my cryptography team is way better than me to do this kind of presentation. Mm-hmm. But in reality, just from a practical standpoint, it really has a significant advantages on top on the traditional multisig that you see in Bitcoin. And I will just name a few. So one is that it is actually, like, you know, one implementation that works across all the blockchain, because it's not a specific implementation for Bitcoin. And then Ethereum, they actually don't have multisig, so you need to use smart contracts. And Ripple, they have like a different way that they basically created their multisig. You basically create this kind of protocol. It works on the encryption algorithm, and then you're scaling it across all the blockchains. That's why vendors that they utilize MPC can actually support more blockchains in a much faster rate. They just need to deal with essentially set up nodes and some understanding of the protocol for the policy enforcement. But that's basically, like, you know, the uplift. And the second property is that it's actually dynamic. So if at day one you have, let's say, three traders and you want two out of them to trade, to basically be able to send money out of that wallet, if you set up a multisig wallet, which in Bitcoin, which is, like, you know, that is two out of three, and the next day you hire another operation guy and now you want to mutate that structure to be two out of four, you cannot actually do it. You need to actually create a new wallet, transfer all the funds from the old wallet to the new wallet, go to all of your counterparties, tell them, by the way, we changed addresses, don't ever send us to the old wallet, which they can accidentally still do so. With MPC, you can sort of continuously and dynamically restructure the underlying shares. So it's, like, very fluid. We call it, like, you know, fluid private key material, because you can dynamically, like, change it from 4 to 5 to 7, change the internal structure of how many people need to sign it without actually changing the public key, without actually changing the deposit address, which is very important for institutional and enterprise environment, because clearly people come, people leave, so on. And you want to make sure that, like, you know, all the privileges are there. And then there are, like, more interesting aspects over there, that the transactions are cheaper. And, you know, there is also, like, you know, a longer list of benefits, but that's sort of, like, you know, what it boils down to.
Awesome. Well, very, very exciting. Everything that's on the horizon, both technically and in terms of the just general operational work that you guys have done and milestones that you've hit recently. Congrats on the Asian expansion and for scaling up so quickly. I always like to end with a fun one. Michael, if and when the HBO series is made that covers crypto, who do you want cast in your role? And you can choose to be the bad guy. You can choose to be the white knight. It doesn't really matter. I'm curious which actor you would choose to tell your story.
Wow. that's a good one. So clearly, like, you know, we are the good guys. The guys that are chasing after the bad guys. I'm trying to think, like, you know, who's the most, the best one to chase after the maybe, I don't know, like, you know, maybe Tom Cruise.
Tom Cruise. All right. we'll take it. I'm just glad you didn't say Jason Biggs, because the first three times I asked that question, three people were competing with Jason Biggs. So
I hope, like, you know, I hope that Tom Cruise will still be, like, you know, active, you know, by the time that HBO will do the series. Let's put it.
Yeah, exactly. Here's hoping. Well, Michael, it was a pleasure speaking, and definitely appreciate you coming on. We'll do it again soon. In the meantime, thank you, and thank everyone else for tuning in. We'll be back in just a couple of days with another episode of Unqualified Opinions. Until then, take care. Peace.
That's a wrap. Thanks for listening. New episodes of Unqualified Opinions go live weekdays at noon Eastern Time. You can follow me in the meantime on Twitter at 2BitIdiot if you want to continue the conversation or troll me. Otherwise, I'll see you next week.